It's blazing hot outside. You get in your car to turn on the AC to get cold air pumping, but it blows hot air out. This issue is commonly caused by low refrigerant due to leaks in the AC system. You want an easy, all-in-one solution that will restore the cold air in no time. AC Pro Recharge Kits make restoring cold air easy for even those with zero DIY experience in less than 10 minutes. Save time and money versus going to a shop by picking up an AC Pro Recharge Kit today. Be a pro with AC Pro.
Hey, welcome into this week's episode of the Show Before the Show podcast, the official podcast of Minor League Baseball. It is a snowy, Thursday here in Denver, Colorado. Benjamin Hill is in New York City. Sam Dykstra undoubtedly is in the happiest place on earth. As we welcome you into this week's episode, my name is Tyler Mon. What's going on, fellas? How are you? Ben, you're in a very brightly lit room, and the haircut looks splendid.
Thank you. Yeah, I am clean and I'm shorn. I am shorn right now. Sitting here in the Ernie Banks room of the MLB offices on a beautiful spring-like day in New York City. It's, I think, hitting the 60s today, so... You know, it's not the happiest place on earth by any means, but it ain't bad.
All right, Sam, you contend that there was some misrepresentation of you on last week's episode of the Show Before the Show. This was brought to my attention not via you, but via one Josh Jackson, who posted on Instagram about an X that you had posted. I don't know. What do they call them now? It's not Twitter anymore, and I'm off of it, so I get to be smarmy about it. But apparently you contend that Ben had spoken some falsehoods. I want to give you a moment to address these allegations.
excuse me. I don't know what you're talking about, Tyler. I have never once in my life been a Times Square Mickey Mouse. I want to unequivocally deny the rumors from last week that I have in my life, whether it was in March 2020 or any other time, donned a Mickey Mouse costume, walked around and seen Ben Hill and demanded a tip. And then therefore, what was the story that I denied the allegation later and then just said, thanks for the tip?
Yeah, it was $10 for a photo. It was $10 for a photo with you.
You apparently, with a wink and a nod, confirmed it to Ben.
Yeah. It was. I saw Sam in Times Square with a Mickey Mouse costume, but he had the head off. He put it on, tried to act like he didn't know me. Said the photos were, or pointed to a sign that said the photos were $10. I gave $20, and then when I confronted him the next day, he just said thanks for the tip, very like wry and low key. And that's where we stand. So now we have different recollections, but you know, two people's lived experiences can be different. But I'm just going to have to defer to mine.
I applaud your creativity, Ben. I will say that the fact that you could spin such a yarn was incredible, and with such detail about my life that it got to the point where I was sitting there thinking, when did I see Ben in Times Square? Because I wasn't sure where the story was going, and you know, that was a crazy time in all of our lives, but. No, I feel very confident that I was not a Mickey Mouse in Times Square on that evening.
Well, you feel confident, but you seem to be not 100% denying it. Just
I am 100. I said unequivocally earlier.
I don't feel confident.
You want me to go to 100? I'll say 110. I'm 110% sure.
A little shaky. We can agree to disagree, Sam, that your memory is out of place. Obviously, it was a weird time for everyone. People remember things all differently. You know, we can agree to disagree.
Yeah, I think we'll have to leave it at that right now. We're not going to get any further down, further towards the truth this afternoon, but I know what I saw.
I do just want to point out, Ben had me 100% convinced. When we got done, like we hung up, it surprises me to no end that I have not been taken for, you know, I don't really have any money, so I couldn't really be taken for my money. But it surprises me to no end that I have not been duped by one of those like really bad broken English text message scammers, because Ben had me 100% convinced. I was like, why would Sam not have told me about this? This seems weird. And I even said to Ben, I was like, the only thing that didn't add up about it is like 2020. Sam's like a pretty well established employee by then. I wouldn't think like in 2020 he just needs that extra scratch on the side. It'd be one thing if you were like working the late shift, you're an hourly employee, you're not making enough to live on in New York City, and you're like, I gotta find something else to do. That would make some sense. I was a little thrown off by 2020, and still I bought it hook, line, and sinker.
You guys know where I was in March of 2020. I was down here in spring training.
Well, it was January of 2020, actually.
Yeah, it was January.
No, it was January of 2020.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
But you have to say for yourself now.
I would say I should go through my tweets, but as if I would be tweeting like, hey, guys, my shift is from 7 to 9 tonight.
Exactly.
Feel free to pop up.
Exactly. You were just trying to make it look as though you were in Florida doing these things when really you were just bringing joy to tens of thousands in Times Square.
I'll be at 44th and Broadway. That's Sam's Corner, as they call it.
Well, at least now we've established the truth that Sam cannot be 100% sure of where he was.
I am 100% sure. I can be, and I am, and I will be moving forward.
And we welcome you in to this week's episode of the Show Before the Show podcast. My name is Tyler Mon, Benjamin Hill, and Steamboat Willie, my co-host today on this week's episode of the Show Before the Show. We're going to dive in. We're going to talk with our good pal Benjamin Hill as we get closer and closer, although, man, it does not feel like it today from my perch in Denver, Colorado, with a foot of snow already outside. But promo schedules arriving fast and furious, quickly and furiously, I feel like is actually the more grammatically correct way to say that. But either way, they're arriving for the 2024 season. Ben, in your latest edition of the newsletter, you have pointed out some of the ones to be excited about at the AAA level. And we will get a chance to kind of go through these levels. But let's kick things off at the highest level of the minors. Give us some of the highlights in the promo schedules that you've seen so far.
Yeah, this is a March tradition for me of going through every single minor league team's promo calendar, putting together a spreadsheet of everything that I think is of note in any way, shape, or form, slash being a little disappointed the promos aren't as weird as they used to be and not getting as excited for just the completely weird, absurd stuff that used to be on every calendar. But of course, there's 120 teams. There's still interesting things. So since I've spent so much time going through these promo schedules, I'm doing it level by level. Started with AAA. I thought, hey, since this is the work I'm doing right now, might as well write about it. Two birds, one stone. So I went through and I picked one from every month. You know, the AAA season is a very long season. I did not include March, but it starts March 29th and runs well into September. So every month from April through September, I chose one notable AAA promo that I thought was of note or exciting. So real quick, here's some of the things I highlighted in there just to give you a sense of things I'm looking forward to this season. Starting in April 5th through the 7th, the Rochester Red Wings are hosting the Lehigh Valley Iron Pigs, but the Red Wings will play as the Moon Rocks. That's R-O-C-S, like the beginning of the word Rochester, the Moon Rocks. And they're taking on the Lehigh Valley Space Pigs. And this quote-unquote cosmic showdown is because the eclipse is on April 8th. So it's an eclipse-themed cosmic showdown between the Rochester Moon Rocks and Lehigh Valley Space Pigs, April 5th to the 7th. And then if you're in Rochester for that series, stick around for the eclipse itself at the Rochester Red Wings ballpark. I believe it's now called Innovative Field on April 8th. They are hosting a solar palooza with specialty food items like solar fries, nebula nachos, and a planetary plate, planetary garbage plate. I am not sure what ingredients comprise any of those items. What else do I have on there? Legends Night of the Omaha Storm Chasers in May. I thought this was cool. They are retiring Jack McKeon's number, and Jack McKeon will be at the ballpark. Jack McKeon is now 93 years old. If you remember in his second tour of duty with the Marlins, he is, I don't want to say still kicking. That doesn't feel respectful, but he's still out there, 93. And he, just to give you a sense of how long he's been around in the world of baseball, I mean, his playing career started in like the early mid-50s. But he was the first manager in Omaha history. They were established as a AAA franchise, AAA affiliate of the Royals in 1969, played with the Royals name all the way into the 2010s when they became the Storm Chasers. But he managed the Omaha Royals in 69, 70, 71, 72, I believe were the years. So they're retiring his number and he will be at the ballpark. So I thought that was cool.
Pretty amazing. When you said Jack McKeon, I thought, man, is he passed? Because I remember when he took over in 2011 for the Marlins. He was, I think at that point, already 80.
He was 80.
If he's 93 now, he would have been 80 then. And he was one of the oldest managers in baseball history. And wow, I did not realize that is fantastic. Good for Jack McKeon.
Yeah, I believe when he managed the Marlins at age 80, I'm pretty sure the only manager who had ever been older than him at the big league level was Connie Mack, you know, who went all the way up until age 88. In the month of June, I went back to my old friends, Jacksonville Jumbo Shrimp, just because they do the weirdest stuff. I just chose one of their many random weird promos to illustrate, like, hey, this is how it's done. Just do something weird. All it takes is a stupid idea. I think we mentioned this on the pod already, but June 26th is Mystery Egg Roll Night, where the food and beverage department is going to fry up who knows what in a whole bunch of different egg rolls, and fans, for some reason or another, will be prompted to eat them. So more details forthcoming, but looking forward to Mystery Egg Roll Night in Jacksonville, June 26th. July 1st in Toledo is Jamie Farr's 90th birthday. And I did realize I had a nonagenarian theme going on in this article. I guess I just like when old people are celebrated. But Jamie Farr, you know, he was Corporal Klinger on MASH. He's a Toledo native. And in the show MASH, he often would wear a Mudhens hat. And so he made the Mudhens globally famous by promoting them in the show MASH. And, you know, has always been a real proud Toledo native. So on July 1st, which is his actual 90th birthday, they're going to celebrate his 90th birthday at the ballpark in Toledo. And they are wearing Jamie Farr specialty jerseys, which have not been released yet, and more details to be announced. Another nonagenarian, Sister Roz in St. Paul, on August 1st, there's going to be a Sister Roz bobblehead. And Sister Roz, Sister Rosalind, is a nun. Who was banished from her parish for giving massages. And Mike Vec, you know, who was running the St. Paul Saints at the time, said, well, come to the ballpark and give massages. So for decades, Sister Roz at the ballpark giving free massages at the game became like a St. Paul Saints tradition. So you can get that Sister Roz bobblehead. She's not at the ballpark much anymore. I don't know if she'll be at that game. But she, like Jack McKeon, is into her 90s and still out there, hopefully giving massages. And then another one I talked about on the podcast earlier, but I threw this in the article as well. Razor Shines Weekend, Indianapolis Indians, September 13th to the 15th, retiring Razor Shines number 3. He played parts of 9 seasons with the Indianapolis Indians, title-winning teams, became a fan hero for his, you know, likable personality, but also the PA announcer at the time would really roll those R's when he came up to play, and it just became a thing around Indianapolis. You know, Razor Shines. I can't really roll my R's. But anyway, legit hero. And I think it's really cool that the Indians are closing out their season by paying a lot of tribute to one of the biggest franchise icons they've ever had, Razor Shines. So those are 6 AAA promos to look forward to. More where that came from. I'm not sure if I'll get to level by level write-ups of all of them. But I'm going through all the promo schedules and making my plans for the season. And next step is planning those road trips. We'll talk about that hopefully in the near future as well.
Hi, Ben. We shift to Bowling Green. Not actually the Bowling Green team, though. We go to Lake County, where I have no idea if the lane is green. I just thought it would be a nice little tie-in. The Lake County Captains have a suite that is going to have a bowling alley in it this year. It's not green. It's not like grass. But I don't know. Maybe it could be. Tell us about the Lake County Captains. They did something not similar, I guess, last year, but they had a themed suite that was like an 80s arcade last year.
Yeah, you know, Lake County Captains, under new ownership of last year, become one of the more out there teams in terms of the things they're doing, creative endeavors. And they have a retro 70s themed bowling suite with, it's not a regulation lane, but with a bowling lane in the suite, all decked out like a 1970s bowling alley. And I just thought that was really cool. I mean, you go to a baseball game to watch baseball, not to bowl, but to have that suite there is really cool. And I was looking at the bowling alley. The pins look to be normal shape. It's not candle pin, but there's a candle pin-esque quality to it. And I'm sure it's a smaller balls and a smaller lane and all that going on. But I hope to make it out to Lake County, hopefully this season, check out that bowling suite. It also has a captain's disco ball hanging from it that was like painstakingly made into the team's logo, the captain himself. And I just, like I often do on Twitter or X, I was like, you know, why doesn't every team have one? And someone responded, who I think was the guy who probably made or commissioned the disco ball. And he was like, because you have to like individually put thousands of 5 millimeter little glass platelets together to make that happen. And I was like, yeah, I didn't respect the art of a disco ball construction well enough. You know, you can't just like click a few things online and then have a disco ball, custom made disco ball sent to you. Or maybe you can
do that AI.
Yeah, right. Exactly. So who knows? And since we're on the topic of the Lake County Captains, you know, we've talked a lot about Eclipse endeavors going on in the minor leagues. Unfortunately, not really any games taking place outside of in Syracuse, who are hosting a game after the path of after the darkness hits, after the eclipse hits. But there are a lot of ballpark events for the Eclipse with non-game day. The Lake County Captains are taking things in a different direction. And you, yes, you, the listener, if you got $5,000 to spare, you can check out the Lake County Captains on Airbnb. They're putting their whole ballpark up on April 8th to rent out the entire ballpark. You can spend the night at the ballpark and see the eclipse for $5,000. So, you know, that sounds like a lot of money because it is. But if you really got a lot of people together, it's a ballpark. I mean, you can bring a lot of people.
You get the whole ballpark for $5,000? That doesn't seem that crazy.
No, I mean, say if you get 50 people and say, hey, spend $100 each and you get a whole ballpark to watch the eclipse and spend the night in and you know, go bowling in the suite and whatever else you want to do, hang out
with. What if we run our own like stadium ops through this? Like we agree to lease the stadium for the day and then we charge people to get in.
I think
$2 a pop.
Kind of like that idea.
Oh yeah,
I'm just saying like
subcontractors. Yeah, we'll rent it out for $5,000. Say, come see the eclipse at the ballpark. Charge like $10 a head. Then all we need is
500 people.
500 people, and after that, it's all profit, baby. So
exactly.
Let's look into that. Let's look into that. But I appreciated their creativity with that endeavor as well. And as I said, a lot of teams hosting ballpark events on April 8th, where you can watch the eclipse at the ballpark, like in Rochester, Solar Palooza, Erie, Buffalo, Frisco, Arkansas Travelers in Little Rock, et cetera, et cetera. There's a lot going on.
So much to cover on the minor league baseball landscape. Benjamin Hill has it all covered. We will chat with Ben coming up here a little bit later on because we have yet another quiz. Jayhawk Owens off the table. We know it's not him, so that means there's only like tens of thousands of options for here on. But thanks, Ben.
Thank you, Tyler. And even Sam, thank you.
You know, it'd be really easy to make a disco ball out of?
What's that?
A Mickey Mouse head.
Oh, yeah.
Just saying, Sam.
Sam could hang that up in his room to
if you want to loan us your old one. We know it's just gathering dust in a closet somewhere.
Isn't this, are you just describing the DJ Deadmau5? Isn't that essentially
yeah, pretty much. That's a very good point, actually. Thanks, Ben.
Thanks, guys.
Well, time to talk a little bit of baseball with the man sunning himself in the Florida glare. That didn't really make any sense. I'll just go with that. Sam Dykstra, who is down and taking in some Grapefruit League action. Spring break breakout games coming up starting today. We are recording this on March 14th, Thursday. So the first day of spring breakout games will get underway here in just a little while from Florida and Arizona. But Sam, the roster is obviously going to be fluid with prospects regardless. They've been maybe even more fluid than we were expecting because of some trades, a big one that we're going to be talking about here shortly. But give us the first week anticipation and some of the storylines with these spring breakout games fast approaching.
Yeah, I mean, it's very exciting that we're finally here, right? This is a new initiative from Major League Baseball to put prospects front and center. And, you know, we've been talking about it for a while now, ever since it was officially announced. And then last week I touched on the rosters that had officially come out. And as you just said there, Tyler, there have been some tweaks and changes and mostly for good reasons, because, you know, players like Jackson Merrill is going to South Korea for the Seoul series with the Padres, which is great for him because it means he's playing in an official major league games. We just lose him in the breakout game. That's fine. We got Junior Caminero, who was added from the Rays, which is good for us. It's not so great for him. He was actually optioned to AAA Durham a few days ago, but because he's no longer a major league camp, he decided he wanted to opt into this game, which is great. So now you have Tampa Bay with a possible infield of Junior Caminero, Carson Williams, and Xavier Isaac, who was on the show last week. So that's as loaded a group on the dirt as it could possibly get. But, I mean, the big thing that still remains intact through everything that's changed and everything that could possibly happen is that on Thursday, so the day we're recording this, and, you know, we'll talk more about this next week after it actually happens, it's Jackson Holliday versus Paul Skeens. That is the dream matchup. I was talking to somebody yesterday on a different show. We were talking a little bit about breakout, and they're like, oh, that's like Trout versus Ohtani in the World Baseball Classic. And I'm like, I'm glad that's catching on, because that's something I wrote 2 months ago, that it, you know, that lightning in a bottle we got in the World Baseball Classic last year, it's difficult to reproduce, but here is kind of that thing. It's happening in a major league stadium. It's happening on MLB Network. Everybody can watch it. Everybody can see it. We've already got a preview of it. These two guys faced off earlier in the spring. Skeens was touching 102. I think he got Holliday to bounce out in that at bat. So now Holliday, you know, it's a grudge match. Those two guys are going to go up against each other. Holliday being the 2022 number one overall pick, Skeens being the 2023 number one overall pick. So I'm glad everything's lined up for that to officially happen. But you look at some of these other matchups, they're so exciting. I was actually in Washington Nationals camp yesterday. One of the stories of the spring, as we've talked about before, Tyler, is James Woods. I don't want to say breakout, but he's being what we thought James Wood could be, which is a guy with exceptional power, really good speed for his size. And he's playing some center field, playing some right field. There are some clamorings from Nats fans to get him on the opening day roster. I don't think that's necessarily going to happen. I think you're seeing pitchers adjust to him as spring has gone on. But, man, when that guy hits the ball, it's as much power as you're going to find in a spring breakout game. And he gets to play with Dylan Cruz, who was the Golden Spikes winner last year out of LSU, teammates with Paul Skeens. Getting those two guys in the outfield, it's happened a decent amount this spring, but, like, they could be real stars of this game. And talking to Dylan Cruz yesterday, he was saying, we play off each other. Like, we don't necessarily view this as a competition. Whoever's going to end up in center is going to end up in center. The other guy is going to move to a corner. We're totally okay with that, so long as we are both in the game and contributing. So that's going to happen against the Mets. I love that matchup because it's a future NL East matchup. If all goes right for these prospects, we could see them going up against each other for a long time to come. You'll have Luis Angel Acuña in that game, Drew Gilbert in that game, Jet Williams in that game from the Mets. Two of those guys came over in trades last year at the deadline. Jet Williams has become the Mets' top prospect. You look at Padres at Mariners. We were talking before, they lost Jackson Merrill, but they still have Ethan Salas in that game at just 17 years old. You can fully expect him to start a catcher. And on the other side for Seattle, their starting catcher is going to be Harry Ford, who is, as you know, Tyler, no stranger to playing in big games based on his you know, Great Britain experience on the international side. Like, what, when you've seen him play, what stood out most to you about Harry Ford?
It's really just his composure. I mean, he's a guy who, you know, going into the World Baseball Classic qualifiers a couple of years ago in Germany, I think was still maybe 21 at that point. And he just does not look like a guy. Well, no, he's 21 now. We're so old, Sammy. He was 21 last month. So he was 19 at that point. I was thinking, like, he's got to be at least like 23 now, right? He couldn't have been in his teen years. Yeah, no, he was, that's right. He was 19 years old. But playing on that stage and then playing last year as a member of the Great Britain team for the main classic, you don't trust guys that age. I mean, heck, even if he was only 21, it's rare to trust somebody that age in the middle of the lineup, handling a good pitching staff, all that type of stuff. But it's just his maturity and the way he comports himself. He acts like a guy who, you know, to borrow a bad sports cliche, he acts like he's been there before and not in a, you know, he's not flashy, he doesn't show any emotion kind of way. He just acts like he's got a handle on things, which is the most important thing you can do as a catcher. And that's what's really impressed me the times that I've gotten a chance to watch Harry Ford. And I know the Mariners feel very much the same way. You know, a guy who brings so much promise with him, because there are fewer positions in which a leader and a, you know, middle of the order type of guy, but really just an on and off field captain of sorts is more valued and more premium than the catching position. And that's what Harry Ford seems to be turning into in this early stage in his career.
Yeah, for sure. And like I said, like Salas and Ford, they're both catchers. So I love that they're kind of paired up in that game. The reason why they're paired up is that they share the Peoria Sports Complex. I mean, they've been doing a version of this game for a long time, actually. Not necessarily always in front of fans. So I'm glad people get to be included in this stuff. That's happening on Friday. Also happening on Friday in Arizona is the White Sox at the Cubs in Mesa. You get two Chicago teams going up against each other. I'm really excited for that because it could potentially put Colson Montgomery, the future of the shortstop position on the South side, against Cade Horton, the Cubs' top pitching prospect, one of the best top pitchers, or one of the top pitching prospects in baseball with a killer, killer slider. That's something that all people in the Chicagoland area should be tuning into if they get the chance. On Saturday, some of the matchups we already mentioned: Rays at Twins, the Rays that loaded infield, Blue Jays at Yankees that day. Spencer Jones, I would love to see him kind of take center stage there on the Yankee side. He was somebody who continually comes up in trade talks with the Yankees. A lot of teams kind of want to get him before he really, really breaks out. And they've continually held on to him. I mean, a lot of people I talk to, they're like, can you imagine an outfield someday with Aaron Judge and Spencer Jones in it? Two guys above 6'5". I mean, that'll be one of the largest and most powerful outfields we've ever
The good
seen.
news is, if it doesn't work, they can try trading him to the Knicks, seeing what they can get in a deal
Right.
there,
Yeah. Or the Nets, either one. We're New
Yeah,
York City.
either way
It's
it
a
works. You know,
two-team
they got
town.
options.
Exactly. But yeah, so that'll be really exciting. I will actually be broadcasting the Phillies at Tigers game from Lakeland with friend of the show, Dan Hasty, who is the West Michigan Whitecaps broadcaster. So tune into that at 105 on Saturday, 105 Eastern time, I should say. Max Clark is the big name to follow there on the Detroit side. Jace Young will also be there. He was just sent back down to minor league camp earlier this week. So the Tigers should be pretty well loaded up. Phillies have some interesting guys in the mix as well, like Justin Crawford, one of the fastest guys in the game. And then it wraps up on Sunday, Astros at Cardinals and Brewers at Royals. One thing I like about the Brewers, they've included Jackson Chourio in this. You know, we all kind of expect Jackson Chourio to be the starting center fielder for the Brew Crew on opening day on the major league side, but he's still very much a part of their future as much as he is their present. So getting him into this game, he knows that there's going to be a lot of focus on him, trying to justify that $82 million contract. It's not going to happen in one game. He could go for three with three strikeouts. Not a huge deal. It is just one game. This is not a series environment, but still, I would love to see Jackson Chourio really take off here after spending all spring trying to win a major league job. Now he's around guys his age, and you can really see how those tools pop comparatively, like I said, to people his age. So that should be really cool going up against the Royals in that one. It'll be Brewers at Royals in Surprise. Every one of these games feels like a Futures game. Futures game is one of my favorite events on the calendar every year. Because it gets so many minor league talents from across the board onto one field. You know, talking to some people with the Tigers, they are going to lean into that. It's not like they're going to play all their old guys early and bring in the young kids later in the game. They want to mix and match. They want, you know, your 23-year-old outfielder to play with Max Clark, who was playing high school ball in Indiana this time last year. They want these guys getting to know each other and sharing that stage. So I love that. I hope other teams take that approach. And yeah, this time next week, we'll get to talk more about who stood out in these games and what it truly means.
All right, Sam, we have trade news from Major League Baseball. The Chicago White Sox have shipped out Dylan Cease in exchange for a glut of prospects from the San Diego Padres. Dylan Cease, a guy who has put together some amazing seasons over the last couple of years for the White Sox. The trade doesn't really come as a surprise. Maybe the Padres being the team that does pull off this trade is somewhat of a surprise. But tell us about the haul that is going the other way. We know about Dylan Cease. We talked about him so much as a prospect as he was coming up in that organization. But there are four ranked prospects headed the other way, including a top 100 prospect in Drew Thorpe. And this is a pretty good package for the White Sox. Now, obviously, you're giving up something pretty big in exchange for it with someone like Dylan Cease, who you were so excited to have as a piece of your rebuild that never really turned into the rebuild that we thought it was going to be early on when the White Sox were bringing up all these prospects. But an intriguing component for the White Sox now in the next wave of rebuilding.
Yeah, I mean, I was of two minds when this trade went down, and I'm glad you used the word haul, because it did feel like a haul what the White Sox were able to acquire here. And that's the big thing for me, is like, they got a lot of prospects. I think people thought Dylan Cease was going to be this like earth shattering blockbuster, and the Padres do get him for 2 years. Like, that's that, we can't overlook that. You know, they get 2 years of control here. It's not four or five, but it's two, and that fits their window of contending, right? Like, they signed Xander Bogaerts to big deals, Manny Machado to big deals, Fernando Tatis Jr. to a large extension. This is their window. I know they traded Juan Soto because they didn't think they were going to be able to keep him, so they wanted to kind of cash in. But, you know, they should be trying to compete right now and not waste these guys' prime. So buying in with Dylan Cease, it was going to take trading some prospects, and they gave up three top 10 prospects between Drew Thorpe, Samuel Zavala, and Jairo Uriarte. And I think there's stuff to like about all three. But on the other hand, the Padres didn't give up Ethan Salas, Jackson Merrill, Leo Dallas DeVries, Robbie Snelling. You know, they didn't get Dylan Lesko, Graham Pauly, who's going to probably be on the opening day roster. Like, they have a really deep system. And it's kind of crazy to say that after everybody thought the Juan Soto blockbuster from a few years ago was going to completely deplete them. And I'm sure they would like to have James Wood right now, but still, like, they built their system up pretty well again. And then they cashed those guys in, and they still have top tier talent. It's not as deep a system anymore. This certainly hurts. Like, I had to do their three replacements, and it gets less exciting at the bottom of the top 30 now than it was a few days ago. But still, like, the Padres were able to pull off this trade in a way that you look at some of the other teams that were rumored to be involved. Like, the Rangers seemingly were popping up in rumors. I don't think they have as deep a system as San Diego did. New York, Yankees, they have some interesting arms. They don't necessarily have the high ceiling types that the Padres did in this deal. I don't know. It was just a fascinating way to see these guys match up. Now for the players themselves, Drew Thorpe was by far one of the most successful pitchers in the minor leagues last year. Had a 2.52 ERA, 182 strikeouts, and 139 in the third innings. Pitched between high A and double A, got five starts at double A, was even better there, had a 1.48 ERA. It's a changeup that might be the best in the minor leagues. It just absolutely puts the brakes on as it gets to the plate. He doesn't have great velo. It's kind of in that 89-92 range. If White Sox going to unlock him getting to 93-94 more consistently, I think he could be even better pitching prospect. But there's a lot to like right now for Drew Thorpe. Samuel Zavala, it's all projection for him. He played last year's age 18 season between single A and high A. He had a 420 OBP at single A. Can get a little passive at times, but knows the zone pretty well and is willing to take his walks at a young age, which is a strong sign. Had 14 homers, 20 stolen bases. Decent shot to stick in center field. I know the Padres were really enthused by how he took to strength training in the offseason, and they felt like he finally unlocked a little bit more power that they had hoped was going to come at some point. It seems like it's going to now in his age 19 season. Now it's the White Sox who get to reap the rewards of that. And then Jairo Uriarte, if you look at his season, you see 27 games, 21 games started. You look at his time in double A, he shifted to the bullpen. That should normally sound some warning bells for a prospect if they're starting to work in the bullpen at double A. But actually for Uriarte, I believe it's because San Diego was considering calling him up down the stretch to be in a bullpen role. So they wanted to get him ready and used to that. And then when it was clear that they were not going to be competing, they moved him back to starting with the San Antonio Missions. Really athletic on the mound, only 22 years old, 6'2", fastball, slider, changeup, all get at least above average grades. He can sometimes be out of the zone, and I think he's at his best when he's getting chased and the stuff is really good. But double A, triple A, major leagues, those guys are going to lay off that a little bit, even if the stuff is as wicked as it can be for higher Uriarte. It's a fastball in the mid-90s. He can touch 100 miles an hour in shorter stints. So the White Sox system right now, you look at what they're trying to do, they're building for the long term. Would they have loved to have gotten like the prize prospect, like a big number one that they could put alongside Colson Montgomery? I'm sure they would like that. but they get three more lottery tickets here. There are three more paths. Like Drew Thorpe or Iriarte could become mid-rotation starters, but now they increase their odds because they have two of those types instead of just one. Zavala could be a future starting center fielder, but he's, you know, he's, you kind of add him to that mix. They don't really have a lot of great outfielders. So now you include him with those two arms. That's something promising. They get Steven Wilson, who's obviously going to contribute to their major league bullpen right away. So at least there's something they can point to on the MLB side. I think both teams did well here. We'll see what Dylan Cease is going to do over these next 2 years. If he wins a Cy Young and none of these guys make it to the major leagues, that's certainly possible. But I think we could look up a year from now and look at Drew Thorpe and Iriarte in the Chicago rotation, Zavala at Double A, maybe in the top 100 at some point. It's the White Sox farm system at least got a lot better after this trade.
How about the start to the pro career for Drew Thorpe, by the way? The second round pick, 61st overall out of Cal Poly in 2022, did not pitch that first season last year, makes 23 starts between two levels in the minor leagues at High A and Double A, 14-2 overall, 2.52 ERA, 182 strikeouts against 38 walks and 139 in the third innings. Opponents hit 200 against him. His whip was 0.98. He was a two-time Sally League Pitcher of the Week, Pitcher of the Month in June, Sally League Pitcher of the Year and Postseason All-Star. He was the Eastern League Pitcher of the Week in August and then the Eastern League Pitcher of the Month for the entire month of August. And now he's been traded twice in 4 months and a week. He was sent from the New York Yankees to the San Diego Padres in the Juan Soto deal. And now he's going to the Chicago White Sox. That is a, talk about a whirlwind last 12 months for Drew Thorpe.
Yeah, it's so fascinating to me that he was included in this trade. I mean, it's got to be a little bit of a bummer for him because you go into the offseason, you're like, oh, well, I was traded for Juan Soto. That's pretty cool. Like, this organization wanted me. They sought me out in this deal for an MVP candidate. And then you get moved again pretty quickly. Like, you might start thinking, does anybody want me? I think teams do. I think that's,
or does everybody want me?
I think it's closer to the latter. I think he's a valuable trade chip, right? And the Padres are wheelers and dealers. I mean, AJ Preller likes his trades, right? So the reason why you go out and acquire Drew Thorpe is to add him to your farm system. Part of the reason why you build up a farm system is to pull off more trades. I mean, it's kind of unfortunate part of the business, but it is part of the business. And I guess going through it once, maybe that helps a little bit more too for Drew Thorpe. I don't know. I would love to pick his brain about that someday.
Yeah. Chaos in life. At least he's, you know, he gets to stay in Arizona. It's not as though he's going, now he's got to shuttle all of his stuff over to a Grapefruit League team. That's kind of nice, I guess, if we're looking for silver linings.
That is true. That is true.
Goes from Peoria to Glendale. It's not too far of a hike. A little bit better than from Tampa to Peoria.
That is true.
All right, Samuel. Well, we are, it's interview time. Tee it up for us.
Yeah, so like I said, I was in Nationals camp yesterday. They have this area that they call Hope Row in the clubhouse, which I find fascinating. Davey Martinez talked about it on MLB Network yesterday with Robert Flores and Mark DeRosa. But they love grouping their prospects together because there is so much emphasis right now on what they call the baby Nats. The guys like Dylan Cruz, James Wood, Trey Lipscomb, Darren Baker, Robert Hassel III, who unfortunately has a groin strain right now and will be out for a little bit. But it, very much a key part of that group is Brady House, the number 48 overall prospect in MLB pipelines right now. He was the 11th overall pick in 2021, suffered a back injury in 2022, so didn't meet expectations by any means, but came back last year fully healthy, climbed three levels, went from single A to high A to double A, showed a really good hit tool. He hits the ball hard a lot. That's how he ended up batting .312 last year, had an .862 OPS, 12 home runs in 88 games, swiped 9 bags as well. They moved him from shortstop to third base. We're going to talk about that a little bit. But the key thing to me as part of this interview is what he learned from that back issue and like how he put that in the past, what his goals were for last year, and how he's kind of carrying that forward. So here from West Palm Beach is me talking to Nationals prospect Brady House. You know, this is your first spring training as a non-roster invite. How do you approach that, being in that clubhouse?
first off, I'm just trying to enjoy every minute of it. I mean, I'm just grateful that I was one of the ones being able to get to learn from all of these guys in here. I mean, we have so many guys in here, and a lot of them were guys that I had just met this year, and then a lot of them were guys that I had already knew. So it's great kind of to have people that you know, but also guys that, like, you come in here and didn't know.
Right. So, yeah, what's something you picked up from being around guys? And, you know?
I think just the way they go about their game. I mean, I'm the type that, you know, I'm here, I enjoy baseball, I love playing it, but it really doesn't define who I am. I mean, I get happy about a lot of things outside of baseball as well. So, I mean, being able to come in here and get my baseball work done, but then whenever we're not playing baseball, being able to kind of unwind and hang out with all of them and play video games, like, that's what I get happy about that too, you know, like, right. not everything hanging out with them has to be about baseball. Like, it can be other things too. So
yeah, and you know, there's a real solid core of the farm system here. The guy you mentioned, guys you recognize, guys you played with, yeah, in that room. How do you gravitate towards, yeah, those guys, and especially in those moments off the field?
I think it's just, talking with them could be one, but then I think it's just them inviting us in. I mean, right. It's like they could go about their business and just do their own thing, but they take the time to, you know, include us and do things with us and take us here together. So, like, it's great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and, you know, coming off last season, you played at three different levels, were successful at three different levels. What did you take away from your stops in Fredericksburg, Wilmington, and Harrisburg?
I'd say they all, for me, it was just like every single level had its different challenges. I mean, I was adjusting different at every level, and it was tough. But then once you start adjusting, it makes it a little bit more okay. I know what to do now. It's not like you can perfect it in the game, but, like, going about your work in practice, I mean, it's going to be different everywhere you go. So once you learn how everything's going and what everyone else is doing, it's kind of easier to navigate. Yeah.
Yeah. What do you feel like was the biggest adjustment you made by the time you got to Harrisburg from where you were in Fredericksburg?
I think at the end of the day, it just comes to, like, plate discipline. I think that's one thing for me, is, like, patience is something that I've been working on. And I want to say that from Fredericksburg to Harrisburg that I got better with my plate discipline. There's still a lot of room for work. Obviously, we're doing that in spring training right now. But, like, throughout the season, I was just like, be patient. I mean, you get three strikes for a reason. So, right, like, it doesn't have to be go get that first curveball that's a strike. If you don't want a curveball first pitch, then you got two more strikes to figure it out.
Right.
So.
Yeah, was that just being jumping? How much does that kind of come from, like, your high school success, knowing you could probably hit everybody in high school, and now you're facing 81-mile-an-hour curveballs at spin rates like 2,700?
I think part of it is, like, me just getting up there and the first pitch I get to hit, like, I want to hit it. And it's got to be, like, the mindset of, okay, I can – that pitch might be a strike, but can I hit it well? Like, the pitcher's not just throwing me strikes for me to hit. He's throwing me strikes to get me out. So, like, I got to find a pitch that is a strike, but I can also do something with it.
Right. Yeah. One of the big things I feel like for you last year was just being healthy.
Yeah.
How much did the back affect you from 2022, and how long did it take to get over that?
That was my goal. Everyone asked me what my goal for last season was. I don't think I ever said one time any stat, any average, any level that I wanted to be at. I think I told everyone that I wanted to play a healthy 2023 season, and I played a healthy season. Like, there was not one game that I was in the lineup where I had to come out because I felt something in my body. And then this year it's even better. Like, no issues. Like, I it doesn't even feel like I had a past injury. I feel great at this point, and I'm working hard to keep my body healthy. So,
how would you describe what the back injury was?
I think it was just like whenever I first came into pro ball, I think it was a little bit of what's the word? I would kind of say whenever I came into pro ball, it was not knowing myself going into the – it was 2022 when I got hurt. Going into the 2022 season, I just didn't know myself. I had never played a full season before, so I wasn't strengthening the areas of my body that needed to be strengthened, and it was kind of just taking a toll on my body. And, you know, right once I got in the weight room and learned how to use muscles differently, like my glutes and using my legs the proper way, I mean – it just, there's been no problem ever since. So that's all I've been focused on, like, since then. It's just working muscles in my body and using them so my back doesn't have to do anything.
Right. Yeah. Do you feel like you were fighting through the back injury, like trying to play through it and try to prove that you could play every day?
I mean, I don't really remember much. It was like a crazy time, but... Right. I just remember that it didn't feel like a big deal to me. I don't know.
No, that's right. Just going back to last year, I'm always interested in talking to guys who play in extreme parks. So Wilmington is pretty extremely pitcher friendly. What is it like playing there as a hitter?
I was talking to somebody about this the other day. I loved Wilmington. A lot of baseball teams and guys that come in, they don't like the park, but I'm fine with not seeing home runs all the time. I mean, base hits are just as good. So, yeah, I mean, I loved it.
Do you take it as a challenge as a guy who is a little bit of a power guy?
I mean, I guess so. I mean, if it goes out, it goes out. It's really, I mean, from playing there, it's really tough to do that, but I enjoy getting like a line drive to right field just as good as I do a home run.
So, yeah,
but that's just me.
No, that's fair enough. Yeah. I like that. And then when you got to Harrisburg, I mean, that team was absolutely loaded down the stretch. What was it like looking around that clubhouse and realizing how much talent was in one room?
It was awesome. I mean, I had played with most of those guys previously, so us all getting to be in a lineup together was like, It was awesome.
How was it being in the middle of that lineup? Like, you can't be pitched around. None of you guys can be pitched around because there's somebody behind you. How do you feel like that affected how you were approached by other teams?
I guess people look at it that way sometimes, but as a player, like, I just don't look at it that way because it's like I go up in the box and I can't think about how the pitcher's going to pitch me because I've caught myself doing that in the past years. It's like, thinking what the other team is trying to do, and that just gets me in trouble. Kind of, I gotta just stay with my approach and go up there, and that's kind of when I'm most successful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of the other big things for you last year was moving to third base full time. Mm-hmm. When did the Nats come to you and say they wanted to move you from short?
Last year before the season.
Okay.
Yeah.
So was it? Were you in spring training when that happened,
or did they give
you like a heads up?
They gave me a little heads up before actual spring training started. So, like I said, like I kind of split my time between here and Georgia. So while I was here, I still got to do my work and stuff here at third base. So I was kind of getting the best work. So
mm-hmm. Yeah, what's been the biggest adjustment moving over there now that you're a year into it?
Not enough time to, or not, I wouldn't say not enough. It's just less time to react than shortstop. And I like that though, because being at shortstop, I don't like the feeling of sitting back and waiting on a ground ball to come. I just like reacting here and there. So. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and both you and Yo-Yo Morales were in Harrisburg, two third basemen. How do you guys kind of balance each other? And I know like it's a good problem to have, but there are two good guys at the hot corner.
I mean, he came to Harrisburg, and we kind of just all did the same thing, and we played where we were supposed to play. We all got moved around. It was kind of like the end of the season, and we were all just having fun finishing it out, seeing how good the team could do by the end of the season. So we were all just getting moved around, and it was a lot of fun those last few weeks.
Yeah. How much were you guys talking about, like, you know, between yourself, Cruz, Hassel, Wood, like down the line, Yo-Yo, that this is the future of Washington in this room?
Honestly, not really at all. I mean, I just never really like to look into something that much. I kind of go by focusing on the present, because, you know, you're not going to get anything out of worrying about tomorrow. So kind of just staying in the present, and then whatever the organization, you know, decides at the end of the day, that's what's best for the team. So, yeah.
Yeah. And do you find it difficult to block that stuff? Because, like, I talk to a lot of people and they say double A is when you start to feel close. I know you got there at the end of the season, so you weren't exactly expecting to be in Washington, but, like, how close did you feel then, or how do you kind of block out feeling that close?
I think just whenever you have someone as great as Delino as your manager, and he's bringing you here every day. I mean, he was great to me. He brought me in every day. He talked to me every day. He was like, "Hey, kid, listen, like, we're not thinking about anything that's going on tomorrow. We're here to play this game. We're gonna practice, and I'm gonna prepare you. Like, we're gonna prepare for this game that's about to happen tonight. You know what I'm saying?" Yeah. So, that's kind of what kept me focused. Is like, hey, I'm here to play today. I'm not here to think about if I'm gonna play 2 or 3 months from now. Like, where I'm gonna play and all this stuff. So,
yeah. No, I like that a lot. Mm. Going back to what you're talking about in terms of improving your patience, how do you work on that in the offseason? You facing any guys' lives? Or how do you do that?
Yeah. Before I came here, I started ramping that up, and it's just kind of like a mental thing. Like, you have to say, like, this is not a real game. It's time to work on things while you can. So I just tried to work on things while I could, and I didn't have an umpire behind the plate, so I just did whatever I wanted, basically, you know, whatever. If I didn't want to swing, like, that's kind of what helped me with my patience, was doing that. Mm-hmm.
This podcast to bring you another thrilling edition of Ghosts of the Miners. Now, here's your correspondent and host, Joshua Jackson.
Welcome back to Ghosts of the Miners, in which all of you out there in Radio Land must identify the legitimate historical ball club or player hiding amidst the fraudulent pair. One once brought a baseball burg into the 20th century. The others, well, we're still waiting on the others. In the last segment, I asked you which of the following minor league baseball teams did at one time exist. A. The Manassa Punchbugs. B. The Mansfield Haymakers. C. The Lennox Knockouts. I heard you clear as a bell if you picked B. The Mansfield Haymakers, a team that slugged its way around the old Interstate League from 1897 to 1900. Representing the seat of Ohio's Richland County on a fork on the Mohican River, the Haymakers weren't around for long, but they did make a bale or two while the sun was shining. Approximately halfway between Cleveland and Columbus along Interstate 71 today, Mansfield was founded in 1808, and thanks largely to the arrival of a few railroad lines in the 1880s, its population boomed by a factor of about 5 between 1850 and 1900, when our Haymakers were making baseball for, hey now, nearly 18,000 souls. The Haymakers moniker ties the area's agrarian origins to the production and distribution hub Mansfield was becoming. Before a haymaker referred to a mighty clout, it referred literally to a person and or machine dedicated to cultivating herbage and drying it for livestock food. There were several amateur and sometimes professional or semi-professional haymakers ball clubs in the late 19th century, most in places more rural than the teams they were in competition with. And the name of the Interstate League of the Haymakers Day did not refer to the I-71, which would not open until the late middle of the 20th century, but to a circuit of teams representing states in the eastern middle of the country. In 1897, the Mansfield Club, 63 and 61, finished in fifth place, ahead of two other Ohio teams, the Youngstown Puddlers and the Springfield Governors, and one from West Virginia, the Wheeling Nailers, and behind teams from Indiana and Pennsylvania, as well as two more from Ohio. The Haymakers' most forceful year was 1899. Featuring a 21-year-old infielder named Miller Huggins, you remember him as the Hall of Fame manager who helmed the Cardinals of the teens and the Yankees of the 20s, and minor league legend Piggy Ward, the Mansfielders knew how to party in 99. They finished 86-54, exactly one game behind the Newcastle Quakers in a decidedly unfriendly pennant chase. In a historical context, 1899 was perhaps also the Haymakers' most interesting year. It opened with a free-for-fans exhibition against the Black Barnstorming Colombian Giants, who knocked out the Haymakers 8-7. A couple of Mansfield players, most notably Tennessee-born outfielder Jack Flournoy, who sat the game out, objected to playing against the black team, and some Mansfield fans reportedly booed Flournoy for the next several games. The Haymakers never got off the mat in 1900, and the whole of the Interstate League failed to answer the bell for 1901, replaced by the Western Association, which had no Mansfield entry. In fact, with the Haymakers gone, Mansfield went five seasons without minor league baseball of any kind. Fans had to endure a heavy weight. And that's how the Haymakers fell punch drunk. Now, on to the question for next time. Which of these players muscled up on the ball in the minors of yesteryear? A. Alan Virile. B. Joe Brawny. C. Ken Strong. Want to know the answer? Get lifted. Or tune to the next Ghost of the Minors. But for now, you'll have to excuse me. My producer, Ben Hill, is heading to spring breakout, and I've got to stuff him back in.
Big thanks to Joshua Jackson for swinging by the show before the show. Josh sent me a news clipping I've noticed, or I've noted on this podcast, that Josh, sometimes I'll log into Slack and Josh will have just sent me like a clipping from an old timey newspaper from some of the ghosts research that he's doing. And this is, I don't know, this probably looks like it's from about the 1920s. It says, an exchange says that an Irishman lately arrived in America and who had never seen a cross-cut saw was passing along a country road one day when he observed a man and a boy sawing a log with one of those saws. Paddy, they just refer to the man as Paddy, which seems very offensive. Paddy could not understand it and gazed upon them for a long time and was impressed with the idea that the man was trying to take the saw away from the boy. So, you know, like on one side, somebody's pulling with a saw to try to cut down a big tree. This evidently, this rube that the newspaper just dubbed Paddy thought that this was just like an eternal struggle for the saw that happened to also be cutting the wood. It continues, he thought that the latter would not be able to succeed in getting it away from the former, so he ran up behind the man and struck him in the back of the head, knocking him down, at the same time shouting to the boy, now take it and run, you little devil. That was a,
yeah.
That was a newsworthy account at one time. That made it into a newspaper.
Yeah, Josh sends me this kind of stuff as well, and he didn't send me that one. I guess he sees various clippings and thinks, like, who's my best audience for this? He sent me one yesterday that the headline was, a chicken thief caught. And the little blurb was, the officers have the right man. He admitted taking chickens from the hen house of Perry Edwards, north of the city. So all sorts of weird little blurbs you can find in old newspapers. And Josh Jackson's tracking them down. In the process, they're just bonus bits as he researches Ghosts of the Minors each and every week for everyone's pleasure.
It really is so great. I feel so lucky to be the type of person who gets these headlines, such as Nurse Has Appendectomy or Murderer Arrested. Anyway, all right, before we get out of here, we're going to do another Guess the Player with your pal and ours, Benjamin Hill.
Yeah, why not? We're having fun with this. And this is the guy, perhaps a more well-known name, but a really interesting career. And he came to my mind because he was one of those players who didn't give it up until he had to. His last appearance in professional baseball was at the age of 42 with the Syracuse Chiefs. And he did not do well, and that ended his career. The Syracuse Chiefs were a Nationals affiliate at the time. He never played for the Nationals whatsoever. But he went all the way up until age 42, trying to get that one last shot. The year before, in 2016, he played very briefly for two teams he's not associated with much, particularly the Chicago Cubs. He has to be one of the most obscure members of that 2016 World Championship team. He played three games. And I'll tell you this, he's a pitcher, two scoreless innings, and he did not allow a run. He also pitched four and a third scoreless innings for the Giants that season and did not allow a run. So at age 41, he barely pitched, but he had the distinction of not allowing a run for two different teams. But let's go back to the beginning. This pitcher was signed as a position player as a shortstop in 1995 in the sixth round by the San Francisco Giants. He then played for the Bellingham Giants in the Northwest League as a hitter. The Giants wanted him to become a pitcher. He said, nah. He went back to college in 96. And then in 97, he said, okay, I'll give it a try. Then his first year as a pitcher was 1997 with the Salem Kaiser Volcanoes. And that's because Bellingham moved to Salem Kaiser in 1997. He spent a lot of time in the minor leagues and did not break out in the majors for a long time. He pitched for San Jose and Shreveport in 1998. That'd be the Shreveport Captains, who later became the Swamp Dragons and then relocated to Frisco. In 99, he was with Fresno, the Grizzlies, when they were a AAA team, as well as the Shreveport Captains again. In 2000, he pitched for Fresno and for Fresno, yes, but also for San Jose and Bakersfield in the Cal League. And I was just like, wait, what? How do you pitch in the same organization for two teams in the Cal League? 1997 through 2000, the Giants had two Cal League teams and when that was a high A league and no single A team, no class A team.
Wow.
And I had no idea about that. So he ended up pitching brief stints in 2000 for both of the Giants California League affiliates. Which is strange. I did not know that teams ever doubled up in one level, let alone one league. But the
Giants, the complexes,
yeah,
the complex leagues, the Gulf Coast, and
yeah, they do it. The complex leagues, but that sort of thing I was not aware of. And then in 2001, they went to Hagerstown and just kept San Jose and left Bakersfield, historic Sam Lynn Stadium. Anyway, this pitcher finally had a breakout season in. What year did he really break out here? 2003 with the Giants. Finally got a foothold in. And that was the first year he switched from a starter to a reliever. Then he went to Minnesota for a number of years. For 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 years. Then Texas, then Detroit. Then those very brief periods with the Cubs and Giants. And then finally finishing it up with the Syracuse Chiefs in 2017.
Jeremy Affeldt?
Incorrect.
I don't know why that name comes to mind.
So we have
good guess.
A guy drafted as a position player, spent the majority of his major league career with the Twins, switched to a reliever in his last year with the Giants, and then with the Twins and everyone else, he was a reliever. And a well-known reliever at that. Well-known reliever with the Minnesota Twins.
I'm thinking of two names.
In 2004.
Joe Nathan? Nathan?
It is Joe Nathan.
Wow, nice work, Samuel. That was good. Joe Nathan, yeah. Yeah, did not know he was originally drafted as a position player.
Yeah, I didn't know that either. And he didn't have a solid season in the bigs till he was 28 and didn't record a save until he was 29. So his like prime when he was really reeling off saves for Minnesota and then a little bit for then for Texas as well, occurred in his mid to late 30s when he was really the most elite that he had been. So a guy who who switched positions, became a pitcher, struggled in the minors, well into his late 20s, and then finally was elite in his mid to late 30s, and then didn't want to give it up and kicked around all the way till age 42. 2017 Syracuse. That was an interesting time for Syracuse. 2017 was the last year that that team was owned, a community-owned team. They'd done a stock drive decades before, and they were still under that ownership model. Then before the 2018 season, the Mets bought Syracuse, and that led to a weird 2018 season in which the Syracuse Chiefs were owned by the Mets, but still a Nationals affiliate. And then in 2019, the Mets came in, they changed the name to the Mets, and they remain. So that's what I like about looking at these players. You just get have all these tangents, like two Cal League teams for the same organization, weird eras of Syracuse history, switching from a position player. Being pitching for Bellingham and then hitting for Salem Keizer at the same level, all sorts of little weird quirks when you dig around.
I did not remember that the Syracuse club was at one time owned by the Mets while still a Nationals affiliate. That is definitely weird.
Yeah, 2018 season, and the Mets AAA was playing out the string in their affiliation with the Las
Las
Vegas.
Vegas
Yes,
51s.
Las
Yeah.
Vegas 51s.
Yeah.
So at Cashman Fields. So that was during the days when Vegas was like a very non-desirable location because Cashman Field was beat up and geographically Las Vegas didn't really work for most major league teams. So Las Vegas was kind of like a place of last resort for in the AAA level for a long time. But then 2019, that beautiful new ballpark opened up and that flipped the script. And then they, became an A's affiliate. And the Mets went to Syracuse. The Nationals went to Minnesota, or went to Rochester. Rochester had been Minnesota. They eventually went to St. Paul, et cetera, et cetera. Dominoes.
I'll close the loop on this. Where do you guys think Joe Nathan ranks all time in saves?
Ooh, that's a good question.
Well, I know he's in the upper 300s from doing this research here. So I'd say he's in the top,
Got to be top 10.
if not top 10, top 15.
It, what, put a number on it.
Four,
Four, 14.
He's exactly 10th.
Wow.
Wow.
Right
There you
between
go.
the two of us. Which
Yeah.
one of us
Right.
gets that on Price is Right rules? Is it lower? Yeah, I guess Ben would get it because I went over. I went
He
higher.
went over and he was closer, 7-3 away, 14.
Well, yeah, that's true. That's true.
There you go. But I did have the luxury of having researched his career. But yeah, he didn't record his first save till 29. So I bet that if you look at all-time major league save leaders, I bet that that's probably the latest recorded first save. Although, maybe not. Dennis Eckersley, is he up to? Anyway, we could go down rabbit holes forever.
Dennis Eckersley is ninth, if it helps. But Dennis Eckersley did get a save in his age 20 season.
Okay.
Didn't become a full-fledged closer until he was 32, but his first official save was in 1975 when he was 20.
Wow.
So there you go.
Amazing.
Anyways,
That's amazing.
another good one, Ben.
That is good stuff. That is very good
Thank you.
stuff, Ben.
Thank you.
Yeah,
Yeah.
read that.
And I say it every time. Email me, benjamin.hill@mlb.com, if you have a player that you think is their career is interesting and has a good minor league component. And we'll riff about it,
Yeah.
maybe.
Yeah. It's all kinds of fun. It's all kinds of fun for us. Nice work, Sam. Well, that'll do it on this week's episode of the show before the show. Yeah, get in touch with us. Podcast@MILB.com. For Josh Jackson, Benjamin Hill, Sam Dykstra, all the rest. My name is Tyler Mon. Next week, Bruce Springsteen joins the show. Big exciting stuff. And that's it. We'll catch you then.
Thanks for the tip.